This is Virginia Harding McGrath speaking about the Monomoig Inn, which was run by my grandfather, John Fond Farmer Jr., for many years. In 1884, Captain Sylvester K. Small opened it as the Traveler's Home. In 1885, he added to the building to keep pace with growing popularity. I think perhaps it may be interesting to note that the railroad probably had something to do with the growing popularity. In 1854, it had reached Hyannis, and in 1865, it had reached Orleans from Yarmouth. And in 1887, it arrived at Chatham from Harwich. In 1898, grandfather, John Pond, farmer, bought it and renamed it the Monomoig Inn. He opened it in June. The family consisted of grandfather, aged 56, Mary, aged 46, my mother, Edith, 23, and my uncle, John, 16. 1919 was grandfather's last season. He died in December. In 1920 to 22, grandmother rented rooms but had no dining room. She had no know-how on that end of the house. 1922, Uncle Herbert Crowell, grandmother's brother, died, and she came to live with us, returning to the inn for one or two summers. In the mid-1920s, she sold it to Charles H. and Bessie Snow, who ran it until the early 1930s, when Chatham Trust Company took it on foreclosure. In the mid-1930s, Carl and Doris Chandler purchased it from the Trust Company and ran it until the mid-1950s. Mr. and Mrs. Noyes purchased it, renamed it Cranberry Inn, and in late 1950s, Mr. and Mrs. McGaw purchased it. Dale's History of Barnstable County, pages 599 to 600, says, Sylvester K. Small in 1884 opened to the public the Traveler's Home. It is on an elevation on Main Street, well toward the shore. In 1885, he added to the building in order to keep pace with its growing popularity. It is sought by pleasure seekers in the summer months, but is open all the year. Father had noted in pencil beside it. Traveler's Rest of Joseph C. Lincoln's Partners of the Tide. In 1898, grandfather bought the place and renamed it Monomoig Inn. He was very much interested in the local history, and because this was the home of the Monomoig Indians, he named it Monomoig Inn. Grandmother, mother, and Uncle John came by train, but grandfather drove down with a horse and carriage in 2 days from Swampscott. Grandmother, you may be interested to know, had a bit of a session with Jimmy Hardy, who was doing the painting. She wanted the front door painted green, and he said no, he was not going to paint it green. Nobody down here had a front door that was painted green. He wasn't going to do it. She said, well, all right, if you won't do it, I will. She won. The door was green. The first guest was L.B. Rich, a tea salesman who was father of Bill Rich, who in the 1930s and 40s ran the Southwood Inn in Orleans. That winter, apparently, was a humdinger. Grandfather went back to Boston to work. In November, there was the Portland gale. Grandmother and mother were roused by Dan, the setter dog, and they found that the gale was blowing. The front bedroom windows had blown in. So they got up and put nailed quilts over the windows till the next morning. The next morning during a lull, Uncle John and another boy rode over to North Beach. They thought they'd seen a fox, boy style. And they were caught over there by the second part of the gale, huddled under a door until it was over. John Phillips, author of a sportsman's scrapbook, used to stay at grandfather's going and coming from his gunning shanty on Harding's Beach. And he wrote that for that winter of 1898 to 99 was an Arctic one, and Chatham Bay froze clear over in mid-February, while the glass hovered around the zero mark for days. The pack drove in and piled up on the Brant bars in great jagged icy walls with towering peaks and sawtooth edges, so that you could imagine yourself in Baffin Bay with a seal or a polar bear around the corner. Later he wrote in it, after that February freeze came a blizzard which Cape Cod remembered for years. Soon after the snow began to fall, we started for Chatham, dragging our goods on an improvised sled. For hours and hours, we toiled through the drifts across the ice, dragging our suitcases and a box of live ducks after us until we made the town. That night, we slept comfortably in Mrs. Farmer's parlor, moving a couple of beds close beside the stove. When we awoke, the whole town was buried. It took the train 2 long days and a night to run to Boston, almost a record, I should think. I put that in because I thought that everyone, Mr. Phillips gave Mother the ducks, And she had them set. They had two clutches of eggs. And mother raised the ducks for pets, but they had quite a time because they were going to be in the way of the boarders, so grandfather gave them away. And the ducks came back. He took them back. They returned, but finally, after grandfather said, you mustn't make any fuss over them. Just let them find their way back. So they went back to their new owners. In the summer of 1898, father and mother had their first verbal encounter. Mother and cousin Grace attended a whist party at the Hotel Mattaquasna, where father was manager. Aunt Grace and mother were seated at the same table with father. Aunt Grace asked mother, then 23 and a very popular belle in Swampscott, how she was ever going to get along in Chatham during the winter. And father, towering other innuendos, glared at them and said icily, we managed to survive. The dining and the cooking facilities may be of interest. The dining was family style at two long tables in the dining room. It was a small room off both the dining room and parlor, grandmother's bedroom in winter. Held grandmother's dining table and was used for overflow or special parties. Pastry and vegetable cooking was done by Lizzie, Elizabeth McRae, who cooked for Boston family during the rest of the year. Meat cookery was done by grandfather. A clue to the prices, a sign which I now have hanging in my garage near the back door, says breakfast, 25 cents to 65 cents. Luncheons, 55 cents to $1. Dinners, 75 cents to $1.25. I've lost track of the men coming to the back door since the sign was put up who have said, I'd like 25-cent breakfast, please. The next room to the dining room was the parlor. The stove was taken down in the summertime so as to open up more room. Grandfather's bedroom, where he slept all year, was right off this room. Father and mother were courting there over in the corner back of the stove, and they thought they were thoroughly hidden. And he was bravely holding a hefty gal on his lap, and thinking themselves hidden over behind the stove, grandfather stivered through to go to bed. He'd almost reached his door when, without turning, he announced, thank God, that's one burden I don't have to bear, and went off to bed. Here in this room, father and mother were married, and here I spent many happy hours with grandma and grandpa. The parlor, the little dining room, the front hall, and side porch are now all incorporated in the lobby of the Cranberry Inn. Next came the office. Here the guests registered in the register lying on the slope top of great-great-grandmother Sally Hastings Chenery's secretary. Here they sat when they were not occupying rocking chair row on the front porch. There was a stove for cool nights and chilly days. Next there was the long hall that off which opened the bedrooms. There was a side hall that contained a toilet for the gentlemen, toilet for the ladies, a lavatory, and a linen closet. There was an outside door in the long hall that had frosted and engraved glass. I think it probably was sandwich glass. The upper hall was very much like the lower one. There were four bedrooms on the first floor. Grandpa's room, number 14, was off the parlor. There was no number 13. There were eight on the second floor. As for the attics, Grandma had a smaller one that was over the parlor part of the house. Here she had two cots, bureaus, sea chests, trunks, chairs, and so forth, and it was a small girl's delight to spend the night with Grandma up under the eaves. On the help side, which you reached through a connecting opening, which must have been made by a dwarf because it was so low, you had to duck your head. If you forgot the first time, you remembered it the second time. On the eastern part was a help side, which was larger. Here slept Mrs. Julia Eldridge, the housekeeper, in the part near the street, while the table girls slept on cots in the remainder. There was a small attic over the little dining room. Here, Lizzie the cook, with her niece, the laundress, and the niece's daughter slept. One window was on the west. It must have been very cozy after a hot afternoon. The toilet facilities were somewhat primitive. There were the toilets, which I've already spoken of. Each bedroom had a washbowl pitcher and a pot and slop jar. For the help, there was the back house. The bedroom equipment was simple. There was a bed, white iron with brass or wooden beds, a bureau, a commode with the various equipment, a lamp table with a lamp and match safe, two chairs. The floors were covered with straw matting. On the second floor, there were knotted rope for fire escape coiled near the window. For the lighting, Gas was supplied by a gas plant at the rear of Atwood's store. Later, Grandfather had his own gas plant down the garden behind the well house. There were gas fixtures in the kitchen, the dining room, parlor, office, small hall by the front door and upstairs in that hall, one in the toilet hall, two in the long hall, downstairs, and two upstairs. There were lamps in the bedrooms and the attic. Outdoors, beside the front door, a large square lantern with a lamp inside. It behooved you to either get settled down before dark or have good night vision. Out in the laundry, there was a kitchen stove for heating water and boiling clothes, heating the flat irons, the wash tubs, ironing boards, the flat tines you braced on two chairs and hoped they'd stay put. Here I learned to iron, helping iron napkins and pillow slips and other small things, using one of those stove-heated flat irons that had to be held with a holder. Over in the corner, there was a vat for trying out lard and a grinder for making sausage meat for pig-killing time. This was Grandpa's domain, where he made lard, sausage, souse, head cheese, and prepared the hams for smoking. When Grandpa had his smokehouse located down near the garden, going the first time, he smoked hams and bacon. One of the neighbors rushed up to the back door and called, "Oh, Mr. Farmer, your back house is afire." Next to the laundry was a woodshed. It had been a carriage shed, and it had been converted to a woodshed. And next to that was the carriage house, where Grandfather kept extra carriages. He had a walk-in refrigerator near the back door of the house. Next came the barn, or stable, whichever you prefer to call it. The upper part housed extra carriages and harness and other impedimenta. There was a shed on the left where the hay could be brought in and could be forked down into the mangers through holes cut in the floor. And behind this was Grandpa's workshop, where he made repairs on furniture or whatever needed to be put in condition for the next season. Here there was a workbench and a stove for cold weather, and also for those times when Grandfather and Grandmother had had a small spat and he'd say, "I'm going out to the barn to live," as all men do. On the right was a shed which contained the runway, which led down into the lower part of the stable. As you went down, you came first to the pig pens. And Grandfather always had four or five pigs, sometimes more. He had two sets of pens. Beyond was a hen house. And then in the main stable part, I've forgotten how many stalls there were, but there must have been about seven regular stalls and a box stall. I didn't get in there too much because Madge, Grandfather's bay mare, was a she-devil. I was scared to death of her, and so was Grandmother. And she would get out of her stall, get loose there in the main part of the stable. And you had to be very careful because she was a crowder, and she'd crowd you right up against the wall. And Grandfather had to be very careful about reminding a new boy about Madge, because the new boy would bring Madge up the runway to hitch her in the one of the wagons. And she'd come up in a very docile way with her head down. They'd come up, out, step out into the backyard. The boy would just have a very slack hold on the bridle. About that time, Madge up with her head, jerk the reins loose, and off she'd go. Right down here at Mary Stewart's lawn. Grandfather would say, "Oh Lord, she's gone down to Mary Rockwell's. I go around and around on that lawn. I've got to fix that lawn again." I don't remember too much about the regular clients there at the inn, because I wasn't allowed to be around too much because I would be underfoot in the way and they were busy. But I want to tell you about some of the most colorful things. The Norfolk Hunt Club, which Grandfather and Grandmother always called the Huntsmen. This was a Boston group that came down the day after Thanksgiving. They arrived about noon on the train, and they left Monday morning, sometimes later. Someone asked me, was it all men? And when they stayed at Grandfather's, it was all men. After they stayed at the Wayside Inn, after a few years, I think some of the women came down, but they didn't come down for very long after they left Grandfather's. They filled the inn and the neighboring houses, different houses around where they had grooms. There were horses everywhere. You'd look out and see the grooms riding down the street, riding one horse and leading several. down from the station. They came down in these big freight cars. They were in the stable that Grandfather's in on the upper part of the floor there. They were over in Joe Eldridge's stable. They put up temporary stalls of board and rope. They were everywhere. The hounds were in the woodshed, and the grooms ate in the laundry. But Grandfather had Willie Small cook for them. They sat there, too, when they got a chance, which wasn't very often because the huntsmen kept them hopping, and they roomed out at neighboring houses. The master of the foxhounds was Henry Vaughan, and his particular pal was Charlie Sweet, Colonel Sweet, and they were the long and short of it. Mr. Vaughan was tall and thin, and Colonel Sweet was very short. There was Judge Trask, Dr. Moss, Adna Neihardt, and Thomas Nelson Perkins. Those are the ones that I remember. Mr. Vaughan and Colonel Sweet always came to call sometime during their stay. And then there was Andrew McGregor, the head groom. Their hunting clothes, oh, they were so colorful in their red coats and white breeches, black boots, black velvet caps, white stock and white gloves and their quilts. They were something that out of an English hunting picture, really. And confusion, you've never known confusion till you've been seen an inn yard full of beautiful blooded horses and their riders, some in the saddle, some mounting, some horses being held by the grooms waiting for their riders, horses pawing impatiently, some dancing to be off, chafing at the bit, froth flying, and the hounds, some sitting down, some on the loose among the horses' feet, some on leashes, some held in panting restraint by the long-suffering McGregor who had charge of them. My first encounter with a huntsman was when I was aged 39 days. On Saturday of that year, they rode into the yard to see the new baby. Mrs. Berry, and I don't know where she came from, was the cook. She came several days ahead, and she made mincemeat and got things started. They had beautiful liquor, which they brought and sent down, and grandmother's sideboard would be loaded with all kinds of it, and so would the men. It was in the men, it was in the mincemeat, and they even put it in grandmother's piano. And Mrs. Berry would say, when she finished making the mincemeat, there, just as soon as they get their liquor unpacked, I'll have some of it and put it in the mincemeat. Mother used to say to her, you shouldn't do that. And Mrs. Berry used to say, what's the difference? They're going to get it one way or the other. 1918 was the last year they stayed at the inn. In 1919, Grandfather was too sick to have them. They stayed at the Wayside Inn, but kept their horses at the Monomoy and in Eldridge's stable. And McGregor, he brought his bagpipes to play for Grandfather. He played outside first, but Grandfather, who had been deaf from childhood, from scarlet fever, couldn't hear, so he came inside. He played inside. Grandfather could hear beautifully, but Grandmother, Uncle John, Mother, and I were deaf. And I mean deaf. Have you ever been caught in the same room with skirling bagpipes? I'm sure my brains were addled that day. McGregor told us stories of his clan McGregor and the Rob Roy branch, of which he was so proud to be a member. The pouch of his pipes was covered with Rob Roy tartan, matching the kilt he wore. Whenever I hear bagpipes, I recall that gray November day, and I can still see that sturdy little Scotsman in complete Scotch kit marching back and forth outside the window, his bagpipes skirling the old and beloved Scottish airs. This was about the last of the Monomoy Inn, because December 8th that year, Grandfather passed away, and that ended the farmer phase of the Monomoy Inn.